Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. The Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe is asking a federal judge to block the federal government from taking over its law enforcement and forcing removal of public health checkpoints. This is the latest volley in a back-and-forth legal and political battle between the tribe and state and federal authorities. Frank Pommersheim is professor emeritus from the University of South Dakota and the South Dakota USD School of Law. He's author of the book Tribal Justice, 25 Years as a Tribal Appellate Justice, as well as many other titles. And Frank, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Lori. Great to be here.
This is the time of year when many people are driving across the state listening in to SDPB for the first time. And so I think we should start with a little bit of a background on what exactly is happening with tribal checkpoints. And then we'll talk about the tribe's request to the federal judge. Lay the groundwork for us a little bit, please.
Well, sure. Both at Cheyenne River and over at Pine Ridge, and then later at Rosebud, the tribes decided that in order to protect the health and safety of members who live on the reservation, in fact, all people on the reservation, that it would be a wise thing to do to put up checkpoints that are within the borders of the reservation to briefly check on traffic going by to see where they were going, where they were coming from. And it put that plan in place pursuant to its understanding of its tribal sovereignty to advance the health and safety of all people on the reservation. This was not seen well by the state of South Dakota. Governor Noem sent a letter to the tribal chairman of those tribes threatening to sue them if they did not immediately take down the checkpoints. There was some back and forth between the parties. At one point, Governor Noem offered a plan to negotiate, and the very first point of her three-point plan was that the checkpoints had to be dismantled, hardly something to be negotiating about. And then subsequently, which has led to the latest round, she sent a letter to President Trump dated May 20th, asking for his help in resolving a problem here on the reservations in South Dakota. And she was requesting that the United States, acting through President Trump, take formal action against the tribes to force them to dismantle the checkpoints.
So what we're hearing from Chairman Harold Frazier from the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe is that some of those efforts have been underway with contact and correspondence and phone calls. Tell us a little bit about what the tribe is asking for intervention for. What kind of tactics is the federal government deploying to convince them or force the removal of these checkpoints?
Well, I think the apparent strategy of the federal government is in two parts. The first involved very high levels of the federal government, including Mark Meadows, who is the chief of the White House staff. And he had some direct phone calls with Chairman Frazier about, from his point of view, taking the position, as I understand it from reading the complaint in this case, that the tribes had to take down the checkpoints. And they indicated they were unlikely to do that. And then there was some discussion that the high levels of the federal government had quite a bit of control over money that might come to the tribe through the CARES Act, the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, that they could get more or less depending on how accommodating they were. The tribe didn't think this was appropriate. They understood that they are entitled to a certain amount of money under the act. It was not subject to negotiation. So that was at the highest level. And then I would say at the highest levels, the Bureau of Indian Affairs began to take the position that the tribe was out of compliance with what is known as popularly as 638 contracts. And a 638 contract refers to a federal law that, in recognition of tribal self-governance, permits the tribes to contract with the Bureau of Indian Affairs to deliver certain services that normally would be delivered by the Bureau, in this case law enforcement, and then the money goes to the tribe, and the tribe carries out these responsibilities as part of self-governance. And then high levels of the Bureau began to take the position that the tribe was not in compliance with their 638 contract, and they sent them a compliance letter saying if you basically didn't take down the checkpoints, they would take likely steps to terminate the 638 contract and to take away the funding. And again, the tribe takes the position, which I believe is accurate. They are in compliance with the 638 contract, and the Bureau is out of line in threatening them that unless you take down these checkpoints, we're going to terminate the contract. And I think the tribe then thought, well, we're getting this onslaught of pressure from the federal government, and we think it's improper and illegal, so we will sue the federal government to try to get a federal district court in Washington, D.C. to issue an injunction preventing the federal government from doing anything that would affect their compensation under the CARES Act and to prevent the Bureau from trying to terminate their 638 contract.
Now, I think it's important to also talk about why these checkpoints are in place, according to the tribes, and that has to do with a response that they have decided is appropriate for their communities. And Dr. Deborah Birx, who we've all seen with the White House Coronavirus Task Force, has also reached out to the tribe and said this isn't something they need to worry about, and that kind of confuses me a little bit. Is this just more pressure from the White House to do to take a certain action? Why would Dr. Birx, from a legal standpoint, make that phone call when she is sort of, her job is to reduce the spread of,
well,
of coronavirus?
Well, to me, it's puzzling to suggest that the checkpoints aren't a good idea and that you should think about doing something else when the evidence is that they are working, because fortunately, the things that the tribe has put in place, including the checkpoints, has limited the development of the coronavirus on the Cheyenne River Sioux Reservation. So the evidence is it's working. And why the tribe should be dissuaded, particularly from a medical point of view, a health point of view, to stop doing what is working, to me is quite puzzling.
And three active
cases.
From a legal
point of view, it's some, I guess, policy point of view that this isn't the best way to deal with it. I just think both in the governor's office and in the high levels of the federal government, somehow the checkpoints have become a flashpoint that is intolerable when, from the tribal point of view, they're perfectly legitimate actions of tribal sovereignty to protect the health of people. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. That's what the tribe is doing. And the evidence so far demonstrates that it's actually working. And so why should the tribe be facing kind of this onslaught from both the state and the feds to stop doing something that's actually working, actually protecting all people on the reservation, particularly members of the tribe, particularly elders of the tribe? I think from the tribal point of view, this doesn't make legal sense, and it doesn't make health sense, and it doesn't make ethical sense.
For context, when I checked yesterday, as of July 1st, they had three active cases and only six total cases since cases were first being confirmed in the state. And it's important for people, again, who are outside this conversation normally, Frank, to talk about how many hospital beds they even have. So whereas in a community, if you live in a city like Sioux Falls, you've got two major healthcare institutions. Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe has maybe seven hospital beds, or an incredibly low number of options for people to go if they have the virus.
Well, exactly. To me, that's the thoughtfulness of the tribe saying, let's look at our health resources. Let's look at our health infrastructure. It's very, very limited. And given that it's so limited, we need to take some affirmative action to try to, more than normal, to prevent the potential spread of the coronavirus. So to me, it's quintessential good public policy and health policy thinking. And again, at least so far, the evidence is it's working.
I was reading through your book, Tribal Justice, this week, and These thoughts of things not really being automatic or guaranteed, or what kind of progress needs to continue to be fought for. And for people who are exhausted from hearing about the latest lawsuit or the latest letter from the governor to a tribal chairman or a tribal president and their response, could you speak a little bit in your experience to why this is such an ongoing and consistently urgent conversation from the tribes' perspectives?
Well, I think from the tribes' point of view, they are simply trying to carry out their governmental responsibilities, their historical treaty responsibilities to govern on the reservation. I think from the tribal point of view, we might use this phrase, tribal sovereignty matters. And so for the tribes, they're just trying to engage in good acts of governance. And for lots of reasons, ever since South Dakota became a state in 1889, it has had sort of an ongoing fractious relationship with the tribes and the state. And the tribes aren't trying to offend or harm the state. They're just trying to govern within their recognized borders. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. And hopefully our discussions and other things that are out there indicate that in this particular instance, the tribe is suing the federal government not as a first resort, but as a last resort. And to me, the question is, why is the state being so aggressive on this? Why is the federal government being so aggressive on this point when it's a matter of literally of life and death, and it seems to be working? I think it's important to see, why isn't there, as you're suggesting, why isn't there more cooperation? And I think there's just been a history of problems. I would interject into this conversation to go back to the late Governor Mickelson's executive proclamation for year reconciliation in 1990. And I think that was one of the most important steps by the state government in the modern era to try to begin to understand tribes, to try to effect reconciliation. And with his untimely death, not a single governor since then, and by my count, that's 30 years ago, has picked up that mantle, that challenge to engage in reconciliation and discussions with the tribes. I think that's something that the state leadership, I would urge them to really be seriously thinking about. To get back on track for some kind of period or commission or study to deal with reconciliation.
Yeah. Often this week, as we lead up to Independence Day celebrations and a presidential visit to the Black Hills and to Mount Rushmore, we have been talking about the complicated history of Mount Rushmore. This has also become a national conversation as well. Again, with our, you know, mind towards some of those listeners who are driving through the state tuning in for the first time, can you help listeners understand the legal battle over the Black Hills and why this is still an issue today? Because some of them are waking up to this knowledge for the first time.
Yes, I'm delighted to. The notion is the area of the Black Hills is the sacred area for the Lakota people. That's their holy land. That's where they come from. That's their origin story. And that land was taken, and I mean that literally, by the federal government in 1877 in violation of the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. And even when it was taken, no compensation was paid. So from a tribal point of view, from a tribal spiritual point of view, their holy land was ripped away from them. And that wound continues to this day. And there's a very long, complicated legal history that temporarily culminated in a decision by the United States Supreme Court in 1980 that the federal government had acted illegally and improper in taking this land. And compensation was supposed to be paid, and tribes have resisted that compensation unless it can be complemented by some kind of land return of land in the Black Hills. No one's private land, but some of the federal land that remains federal land in the area of the Black Hills. So for the tribes, from the tribes' point of view, this is the cornerstone of their existence, and that land was stolen from them. And yes, South Dakota was not a state when this happened. South Dakota became a state 12 years after the land was taken. But to me, this is one area of reconciliation. How can the federal government and the state government and tribal governments come together in good faith, being honest, and say, what can we do now to try to effect reconciliation? How can we effect healing so that we can all go forward and turn a new page? But you can't turn the new page until you confront the soiled pages of the past. And as it turns out, that's where Mount Rushmore is. And there's, of course, controversy about from a Native point of view about some of those individuals who are at Mount Rushmore. But I think this notion of reconciliation and confronting the past is necessary, because the past isn't going to go away. The past haunts us, and it particularly haunts us if we don't pay any attention to what has occurred in the past. You know, other nations have been much more successful in this area. We can look to Germany in a post-World War II situation, where it's clearly admitted how wrong the regime was under Nazism, and have admitted that, and have tried to go forward with acknowledging that mistake. South Africa, in the context of reconciliation there, has tried to have, with some success, to have both sides come together and deal and admit the wrongs of the past as creating a necessary predicate to go forward with some kind of partnership and understanding. And I think from many of the traditional people I know, my teachers from days at Rosebud, Stanley Redbird, Albert Whitehat, Tilly Blackbear, they always would emphasize, Frank, we've got to deal with that issue. And maybe amidst all this turmoil that we're facing both locally in the state and nationally, maybe it's time for leadership to step forward and say, yes, it's time to confront that part of our past. You know, not in anger, not in hatred, but in a spirit of reconciliation. But reconciliation requires the predicate of the admission of harm and wrongdoing that occurred in the past.
Frank Pommersheim is the author of Tribal Justice, and he is professor emeritus at the University of South Dakota. And Frank is also a well-known poet. And I cannot resist from asking you as you join us here about how writing has been going during the pandemic. And I'm hoping before we let you go, you might share something with us today.
Well, thank you, Lori. I'm honored to do that. I suppose just like any citizen, any writer, well-known or not, I think the COVID coronavirus set of circumstances is really challenging all of us to think about what does this mean. I think for most of us, and definitely including myself, it came out of nowhere. And all of a sudden, there are these very dire threats to the well-being and health of people all around the globe, all around our country, all around our state. And at least for me, it made me think quite a bit about mortality. I'm not one for charts, et cetera, but my age would put me in one of the categories most at risk. And so it really made me think, what does that potentially mean? Fortunately, no one in my family, both here in South Dakota and back in New York, have been tested positive. So I haven't personally had to deal with any of those issues, but it nevertheless has really made me think deeply about what this potentially means for me, my family, and our society.
Yeah. What would you like to share for us with us today, from a poetry
standpoint?
Sure.
I have two poems that are about the coronavirus, and then one was a poem I wrote some time ago, actually for my students, but I think it's relevant. So the first poem is called Buddha Gets Tested for Coronavirus. And it's written from the perspective of what it might be like for someone like Buddha, like me, like you, who all of a sudden is faced with the challenge of the coronavirus. So Buddha gets tested for coronavirus. I'm going in. If I got it, dark room where I'll never see you. Remember me with sage and sweetgrass. Sing a song, then scatter ashes. Forget and go on. And this was written for my family and all my friends and Hunkar relatives. That's how it seemed to me.
Thank you for that. Please go on.
And one other poem about the coronavirus and COVID was this, and many people have had this shocking experience to see my 7-year-old granddaughter Sophie come over to our house on 200 Forest Avenue here in Vermilion with her mask on, to receive a picture from our 15-year-old granddaughter Sylvia out in Tigard, Oregon, with her in a mask. All of us who are parents and grandparents, do we ever imagine seeing our children or grandchildren wearing masks? I think the answer to that is no. So it led to this poem, and this is called Buddha's Granddaughters Wear Their COVID-19 Masks. Of course, they're still beautiful. It takes my breath away.
Thank you. One and more
lastly,
before we let
perhaps,
you go.
This is a poem I had written several years ago for my Indian law students, and I now distribute it as a bookmark at the conclusion of my Indian law class. And it's trying to speak to my students what I expect of them as their teacher. So it's called Buddha Sends a Hunter Gather a Poem to Professor Pommersheim's Indian Law Class. Cut complicity. Gather reason. Seek balance. Show respect. Find spirit. Pour it all out. And I told my students they can use this to as a bookmark, or they can put it under their pillow so it haunts their dreams.
Frank Pommersheim, thank you so much for being here with us again. I look forward to the next time we talk to you.
Thank you very much, Laurie.